Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 152 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, poet Claire Pollard talks with Julia Coppice about her experiences of motherhood, her thoughts about politics, and how it feels to be labelled a bad girl of the literary scene.
Claire Pollard was born in Bolton in 1978. Her first collection of poetry, The Heavy Petting Zoo, was written while she was still at school. Her fourth collection, Changeling, was a Poetry Book Society recommendation. She has also written for the stage, TV and radio. Her play, The Weather, premiered at the Royal Court Theatre in 2004, and she has written and presented one documentary for television and another for radio. Her latest collection, published by Bloodaxe Books, is Incarnation. I met up with Claire to talk motherhood, politics, and how it feels to be branded a bad girl of the poetry scene. So Claire, you started very young, breaking onto the poetry scene when you were just 19. Your first book was published in the late 90s and by a prestigious publisher, Bloodaxe Books. You've since been very generous in encouraging young emerging poets and helping to foster their reputations. I know that you've sat on the panel for the Faber New Poet series, for instance, and the Next Generation Poets promotion. And you also co-edited Voice Recognition, which is an important anthology of new poets. None of those opportunities was around when you were starting out. So what was it that prompted you to start sending your writing out into the world at such an early age?
Youthful arrogance, I suppose. I kind of didn't know any better. I started writing poems when I was in early sixth form, and my mum got me, it was either for my birthday or Christmas, a subscription to Poetry Review. So that was really all I knew of the world of contemporary poetry. And so I just sent some poems there and they got accepted.
But I mean, were any of your friends doing that? Where did that initiative come from?
No, not at all. I had some really good teachers at the school who were very encouraging. People always gave me the sense that I could be a professional writer, you know. And when I was a little girl, there was a series of books called The Garden Gang, and they'd been written by this child. And I always wanted to be like her, you know. I always thought I could get published while I was still a child. I wanted to be a prodigy. And then after that, I started shooting. Well, Mary Shelley was 17. So I was kind of, you know, I was keen to get published before it was too late and I couldn't be a prodigy anymore. I'd already written, like, novels and sent them out to various publishers and got nice notes back. And poetry was my first.
At what sort of age?
14, 15.
Wow.
I spent most of my childhood wanting to be a novelist. It was only in sixth form that I discovered poetry, really. And that was, I think, largely because I did Sylvia Plath for A-level. And that changed my life, really.
Now, Jules Smith, in an early-ish critical perspective on your work, said of you that one might simplistically think of her as the best-known bad girl among current British poets, a counterpart to the likes of Julie Burchill or even the artist Tracy Emin. It's true anyway, isn't it, that you're not afraid to write about binge drinking, sex and sexual jealousy, subjects that have for some reason previously been the preserve of male poets. Have you made a conscious effort to reclaim those sorts of subjects for women? Or is it just that they happen to interest you and you see no reason why they should be out of bounds to you?
I don't think it's been conscious, no. I think I have a very high threshold. I'm not squeamish. I'm not, you know, I just don't have much sense of shame. I'm often quite shocked when people say, oh, how could you write that? Or, you know, it just didn't occur to me, really.
Ashamed of it.
Yeah. And I think a lot of my bad girl reputation just rests on the fact that I like a glass of wine, really. I mean, actually, I'm a very good girl, I have to say. You know, I met my husband my first week at university and I've been, you know, happily married for for over a decade.
That is quite shocking.
Yeah, and I spend a lot of my time, you know, making Play-Doh alien cakes. I'm really not that much of a bad girl. But when I get out to a good poetry do, I do like a few glasses of wine.
So thinking of the likes of Tracy Emin, one of your poems, or the narrator in one of your poems, says that self-promotion must be in your face. And it takes its lead, and its title, in fact, from Tracy Emin's Turner shortlisted work, My Bed. In your poem, the female narrator describes various unsavoury items that are found in the bed, including a cum rag that's fallen down the side. And then she really forces us to take a close-up look, observe its crisp petals and grubby clag, she says. But the poem also broadens out to talk about the public's taste for voyeurism and docu-soaps, with the narrator also observing that everyone loves to prod a stranger's mess. Some of your lines are clearly meant to provoke the reader. Is audacity a key ingredient in your work? I mean, how important is it to you that your work challenges the audience in some way?
It's very important to me that every one of my poems is, or I hope every one of my poems is doing something new or fresh. What I hate as a reader is, you know, what you often see is beautifully written poems, beautifully crafted, lovely lineation, etc. But they're not saying anything new whatsoever. I try not to never even write a poem unless I feel I have something new to say. Sometimes that's a new angle on something or a new way of looking. Sometimes I actually think I've got a really interesting idea or something I need to say. And sometimes it's just about pushing the edges of something a bit. So in my latest book, for example, Incarnation, I'm writing about motherhood, but what I absolutely didn't want to do is write, and nothing against these sorts of poems, I've seen them done very well, but I didn't want to write poems that are just like, my little child, you're a miracle, I'm going to look after you, it's going to be so lovely. It's much more interesting for me to write about, you know, the welts on my son's ball sack, or I've got a line in one of the poems where I'm comparing him to the baby Jesus, and I talk about the wet gold blaze of his raised bum. So I guess I'm still doing the same thing now with motherhood as I was then with the bed. But yeah, I'm interested in, can I bear witness to something that people haven't talked about before? That's interesting to me.
Or have a fresh angle on it,
yeah.
on the same subject. So just to stick with that latest book, Incarnation, so it contains poems inspired by your experience of motherhood. I think the subject of parenthood has, in fact, always been one of the big subjects in poetry. I'm thinking of Yeats's A Prayer for My Daughter, Ben Jonson's On My First Son. And then even before that, you've got the medieval poem Pearl, which Jane Draycott has recently translated, and Simon Armitage, in which, you know, the father mourns for the loss of his little daughter. All great poems. But then I struggle to think of similarly famous motherhood poems. There is so little from, say, before 50 or 60 years ago. So I suppose what I'm saying is that even when women poets started to publish more, it seemed to take a while for them to gear up to writing about motherhood. Why do you think that is?
I think perhaps the lack of early poets writing about motherhood is because the early poets we know who were women weren't mothers.
I suppose they wouldn't have had time to do both things. That's a good point.
I've been reading a lot of poetry about motherhood and enjoying it, and I've found actually loads of wonderful stuff. I think it's not so much that it hasn't been getting written as that it hasn't been getting read, perhaps, or it hasn't been getting the plaudits or the critical attention. I think when women write it, there's a tendency to dismiss it as domestic and small scale.
So the front cover of your latest book, your fifth collection, features a painting by Louise Bourgeois, who I know is one of your favourite artists. If we can just describe this cover image for listeners. So it's done in a single colour. It's a sort of scarlet, blood red, translucent gouache. And it shows a pregnant belly in which a little inverted human figure, which looks more developed actually than a baby, is clearly visible in the middle of the belly. What's interesting is that So did you want to say something there?
Like, a lot of people have said to me it looks like a kind of devil baby or something. I think because it's quite red and it is, it
more
does
formed.
Look quite developed. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there is a slightly sinister edge to the image, isn't there? But I also found it interesting that Bourgeois painted this picture in her 90s, along with other very similar images, not long actually before she died. And her early work had explored pregnancy and motherhood as well. And then she came back to that subject right at the end of her life. Now, I know that you gave birth for the second time earlier this year, in fact, for which many congratulations. But I'm wondering, how much has the experience of motherhood focused your attention on the whole physical aspect of what it means to be human, what it means to be mortal?
Absolutely. Yeah. You should have written the blurb for my new book. I mean, that's why I think motherhood is such a great subject for poetry and should be recognised as a major genre, that it isn't just talking about how much you love your cute baby. You know, it absolutely makes you aware of what it is to be, you know, an animal, and just, you know, the bodily fluids and the
you can't get much more animal.
No,
than
absolutely.
Giving birth,
you have to get so familiar with, you know, shit and.
Yeah, but I'm guessing. I mean, the idea of physicality is also contained in the title, incarnation. Carnem being the Latin for flesh, that's in there too. But more obviously, of course, the word has religious overtones. So when you were putting this book together, did you begin with the idea of physical incarnation and motherhood, or with religion, or was it a mixture?
I actually began with religion. My previous book was based on kind of folk tales and English myth, and I really enjoyed taking these old stories and these strange stories and looking at them from different angles and reworking them. And I decided for this book I'd do something similar with religious stories, partly because I was brought up Church of England and I'm now agnostic, but I don't really believe in organised religion. But these stories felt like they were part of my DNA. You know, I was brought up with these strange stories of arks and whales and the Garden of Eden and so on. And also I'd been travelling in Jordan and India, and I'd been reading the Ramayana and the Quran, and I was quite interested. I thought in this book I'd like to think about some of these religious stories. Mm. So that was actually the starting point. And I had the poem that contains the word incarnation before I even got pregnant the first time. So I always had incarnation in my mind, and then it kind of came together.
Wow. So you referred there to your 2010 collection, Changeling, in which you build on various myths. And I noticed that in that collection, you quite often write in the voice of female partners of famous men. So you've got a poem in there about Tamlin's wife, in the poem of that name, in fact, who rescued her shape-shifting husband from the Queen of the Fairies. You talk in the voice of Eva Brown, Mrs. de Sade, and even a model posing for Dante, Gabriel Rossetti, and so on. What is it that draws you to these characters? Why is it that you're interested in telling their stories?
I love dramatic monologues as a form. It's I think because I love I poems. It comes naturally to me. I want to write I poems, and I want to write about someone who's in the throes of passion or the intensity of the moment. But sometimes I get bored of writing about myself. So I'm very... And also I have written plays, so I'm interested in drama. So the dramatic monologue is just a form that I love. I'm always trawling history or reading books and just having ideas for dramatic monologues, really. Yeah, I guess it's less appealing to... I do know some poets who've written poems in the voice of, you know, Anne Sexton or Virginia Woolf and stuff, but I always think that's a very high-stakes game because they can speak pretty well for themselves.
Mm.
So I guess that's partly why I end up writing for these partners, because they're the people who don't have the voices in history, perhaps, who we don't...
It's sort of off stage, so you're reanimating them, you're giving them a voice. So that idea seems to be a natural lead to your recent translation of Ovid's Heroides, called Heroines, which really draws on that theme in your previous work of speaking, you know, giving voice to the partners of famous men. One might imagine that it's quite constraining to have to stick to translation. Did you find it a constraint, or Did you discover a kind of freedom in the writing?
I love translating and I've done a lot of it and I find it incredibly enjoyable. I actually find writing my own poems quite torturous, and I think having the idea is the difficult bit, and I can easily go a year without having an idea for a poem. So actually translating feels quite freeing for me. The idea that you can just, I can just sit down and work on this for 3 hours and produce something. And when it's a writer whose work I love as much as Ovid, it just felt like a great pleasure. I was just, every time I looked at a line, I was like, wow, this line's amazing. Or because I was working from some old prose. That was my process. I don't speak Latin. I learnt a tiny bit while doing it. But I had a Latin, I had the original, I had a dictionary, and I had two old translations, one of which was prose and one of which was rhyming. So I knew that that wasn't what I wanted to do, and I was hoping that would stop me being influenced by them. But I was using them really as a crib.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it was just amazing. Every time I kind of looked at a line and then I looked at the dictionary, and then I kind of realised, you catch the tone of voice, or you realise it's a joke, or you realise it's, this is really bold, or this is really... It was absolutely thrilling, and I really got into it. And I was, the whole time I was doing it out loud, I felt like there were pieces to perform. And I was reading my drafts out loud. And there's a kind of, translation's a bit like doing crossword puzzles or something. There's something just very satisfying about finding solutions.
There's the finding of the solutions, but I also find it very interesting what you say about the fact that you've got a thread to follow, you know, frees you up to sort of perhaps be more imaginative than you might have been if you were having to worry away at the idea. So in your heroine's book, there is an assortment of aggrieved Greek and Roman heroines, and they're all addressing their heroic lovers who have in some way mistreated or completely abandoned them. So I know you've developed a very successful show based on the book, which you've taken to a number of venues around the country. Could you tell us a bit about first how the idea for the show came about, and also perhaps how performing it differs from presenting a more conventional poetry reading?
So it began, the show, when I... after writing these things, I just felt like they needed to be performed, that they were dramatic. And I've never really learnt my poems by heart, but I thought, this is the book. If I'm ever going to learn any poems by heart, this is the book. So I started learning a couple by heart. And I performed one night at a party. I was asked to read. It wasn't, I don't just go spouting poetry at parties. And Julia Bird, who runs J Bird Live Literature, saw me and decided that this would make a great idea for a show.
Oh, that's a great story. She was there at the party.
She was. So, yeah, it's brilliant. She got some Arts Council funding. We were very lucky. And the best thing was to have a week working in a rehearsal space with a director, putting the show together.
Mm.
It was just really exciting. I think as a poet, it can be quite lonely, and it was just really fun to do something collaborative.
Because I've read somewhere that you are a bit of, there's part of you that is a frustrated actress. How much acting were you allowed to do?
Quite a lot in the end, because we have these eight women and it was very important. I mean, they're all going to be played by me, you know. It could easily get quite samey. And in fact, a lot of the criticism of Ovid's Heroides comes from people who say it's very samey, all these aggrieved women. So when I was writing it, I found... the thing that was really helpful and really clarifying was to say, what's their motivation for each of them? And once you think about that, that one of them is seducing, one of them is a suicide note virtually, that seemed a way of making sure they all had a different tone.
Yeah.
And similarly, working with the director, we didn't want me to go, you know, full on acting, being really hammy or anything, but just she gave me really careful, thoughtful notes about how to, you know, Medea, I should perform really fast. The queen should speak in a lower, slower voice. We put in some action so that some were restless on the stage and some were very static and so on. And that really helped, I think, distinguish between the different women. And I've really enjoyed acting. I really got into it in the end.
Do you think you'll do more?
I don't know. It's just one of those... It was just... You know, the successful things in my writing life always happen like this. They're kind of one-off.
Yeah.
Things, and it's just...
It's what was required at the...
Yeah,
at the
it
time.
Just worked. It was the right book for a show, and it's been a wonderful experience, but, you know, I have nothing else in the pipeline at the moment.
So this leads me to think about your actual writing for the theatre. You wrote a play and it was performed at the Royal Court. And Michael Billington, no less, compared it to Buñuel's film The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie. Your own play, The Weather, is a play in which an angry daughter confronts her parents against this sort of background of social anarchy and the violently unpredictable weather. I'm just wondering, you haven't done more writing specifically for the stage, but just listening to you talking about Heroides, did it feel a little bit like you were writing for the stage when you were engaged in the translation?
Yes, very much so. I feel, although I'm not writing for the theatre anymore, perhaps my poetry has got more theatrical. Mm. I'm certainly very, very interested in the idea of poetry being oral. You know, there was always this false distinction when I started out between page poets and stage poets, but I think that's really melting away, and the poets I'm most excited by are people who combine the two.
Mm.
And so doing a show felt like the natural next stage for me, in a way, of bringing together my drama and my poetry.
And there are some poems, aren't there, that you read on the page and you can't help kind of hearing them out there or imagining them almost being performed. Now, I think that there's always been a political aspect to your work. Your poems are particularly keen to debunk the myths of this kind of cosy capitalism. I'm just going to cite a couple of examples here, so bear with me. I think you very often express a sense of guilt at living in the comfortable, affluent West, but also you're not afraid to satirise yourself. I'm thinking of your poem Geraniums, which sort of swings between outlandish ambitions like going to Rio or trying out Class A drugs and the safer comfort of the domestic setting where, quotes, on the windowsill, geraniums pulse. It's as if you were poking gentle fun at yourself here. And then other times you break into raw emotion, as you do at the end of Adventures in Capitalism, a poem in which the narrator is desperate to really feel. She cuts her wrists, she slumps in the toilet, snorting cocaine. And then the poem ends with something like a primal scream. And I yell at everyone who cares, I hurt them, because I need something to fucking happen. You will know, of course, Shelley's remark that poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. But can poets really make any difference in a country that is as contented or even as apathetic as ours? Do you think they can make a difference? Do you think they have a duty to try?
I don't think a poem can like directly affect politics, but I think poets and all artists can kind of help create the cultural atmosphere. Mm. I think, you know, you've noticed over the last couple of years a kind of creeping change in language, a change in the way we talk about refugees or people who are coming to us seeking help, a change in a way we talk about kind of multiculturalism and so on. And those shifts in language, I think artists can be part of resisting those shifts or analysing those changes in language. I think you only have to look at kind of popular culture. If you look at the way kind of soaps, for example, changed the way people saw sexuality and changed our relationship, I think.
Just by showing sort of homosexual...
Yeah, just by kind of normalising that to a lot of people, like, you know, my granny and things, it really changed the way they looked at things like that. And I think culture can have that kind of impact, creating empathy, making us look more closely at the language that swirls around us.
Mm.
In my latest book, I've been very interested in looking at the kind of language that swirls around motherhood, I suppose, and the whole discourse. You know, on one level you become a mum and there's this whole new language of kind of tummy time and latching and baby-led weaning and stuff. Mm. But also I noticed in the way motherhood is politicised, the way all the burden of guilt and responsibility is put on the individual person and having a baby is seen as this big choice. And therefore, you know, honestly, you read the tabloids and it's like, you know, you can't use cleaning products, you can't, there's about 80 foods you can't eat, you mustn't. You worry about limescale in your kettle when you're changing the...
So much pressure, it's not helpful.
No, not at all. And it's also, it is political. It is political. I think it is anti-feminist. But it's also about, it's the way our whole society is structured now, which is putting the burden of everything on the individual, I think.
So I suppose this poem is related to what we've been talking about. In your poem Post, hyphen, again from Bedtime, your collection Bedtime, you ask, why do we poets keep cranking it out? Love, death, lovers, mothers, nature, all of hackneyed humanity. And here you are, writing about love, death, lovers and mothers. How would you answer your younger self?
Well, I think when I wrote that poem, the idea of the end of history was very popular. And there was this sense, I felt, it's weird to look back at it now, but when I was at university, like a lot of young people, I felt like everything had kind of been discovered and done and it was all over. It was this late 90s vibe. I don't think anyone would say that anymore. In fact, it's becoming increasingly clear we live in extremely interesting times. Mm. We're kind of living in the future, is what I think to myself most days when I see, like, the adverts that move on the tube and things.
Yes. Yeah.
So I really don't. I mean, I think the best way to stay fresh and relevant as a writer is just to write about now, because nobody's written about it yet and everything's changing so fast.
Yes, and it's something you've always done, in fact. You've always been noticed for doing, is writing about what it's like to be Claire Pollard right now. And that, I think, is what people have found special about your work right from the get-go. I'd love to finish by hearing you read Geraniums for us. It's a poem which, for me, sums up at least one side of what you're about. And I love the image in this poem of the geraniums as sunsets on stalks. It's as if you don't have to travel far or even to go outside to see this sort of thing. It can all be found at home. Would you do that for us?
It would be a pleasure. Geraniums. The thing I fear most is diminishment. The shutting down of possibility. Last night I was greedy for what could still be. I want to go to Rio, I slurred. I want to keep chickens, try mescaline. But tender mornings are about small things. Light tortoiseshelling the flat, a sip of juice, a DVD. I've a fat stack of weekend papers and my husband is whistling Spanish Flea. On the windowsill, geraniums pulse. They are sunsets on stalks, grenadine and coral. I have failed to water them. Fallen petals are saying, you must love this.
I was talking to poet and playwright Claire Pollard. Claire's latest book, Incarnation, is published by Bloodaxe, as are her previous four poetry collections. Her stage play, The Weather, is published by Faber.
That was Claire Pollard in conversation with Julia Copus. You can find out more about Claire on her website at clairepollard.wordpress.com. That's Claire, spelled C-L-A-R-E. And that concludes episode 152, which was recorded and produced by Julia Copus. Coming up in episode 153... memoirist and travel writer Horatio Clare speaks with James McConachie about the pleasures and plights of Welsh sheep farming, the creative criminal record of his youth, and why writers should live it and leave it until it's ready when using real life as material. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.